Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 1:16 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is April 22nd, and it's Friday, so it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, I thought we'd kick off and look at some of the indicators for future recessions, but certainly we can see just on the chart that we have in front of us is the solar ETF, and it's been trending downwards for a year. And we had a nice rebound back into the region of the 200-day moving average, and then it pulled back violently in here this week. And we're going to see a lot of that in the course of this broadcast. But let's first just look at yield curves. So we have the yield curve spread. It was inverted about 3 weeks ago. Then we had a good size bounce, and it's starting to come back down again. So we, and I guess if you're a new subscriber, and we certainly have some of those, you might not be familiar with how the yield curve is. So it's the this one is the 10-year minus the 2-year. Whenever it goes into negative territory, it's generally considered to be one of the most reliable lead indicators for a future recession for anything from 6 to 18 months out. And I think one of the most important things is that every single time we get an inverted yield curve, we get rationalizations. And those rationalizations always argue that this time is different. And we had exactly the same suite of arguments back in 2019. What I find particularly interesting on this occasion is that we're still having those same arguments, and it hasn't really been all that long since we had the last argument about the potential for a future recession. Because back in 2019, it was looking like there was going to be a recession at some point in 2020 or 2021, and then the pandemic hit. So everyone forgot about the yield curve inversion back in 2019. Now, there's also a running argument about the question of which yield curve to look at, because we've also got the 10-year yield minus the 3-month, and that's going in exactly the opposite direction of the 10-year minus the 2-year. And there's a good reason for that. There has been absolute selling carnage in the bond markets, and anything with a long duration has sold off aggressively. So, when we then think about how to think about all of these things, well, when we think about why do we have this divergence, the first thing is that it's quite unusual to see such a just a very wide dispersion. Back in 2019, the 10-year minus the 3-month was inverted in early 2019 and stayed inverted for most of the year, and then it also became briefly inverted in 2020. So on that occasion, you had a confluence of different yield curves pointing towards a recession threat, and you don't have it right now. Eventually, to get the clearest trend signal, you have to have every portion of the yield curve inverted. What that implies is that the 3-month is higher than the 6-month, the 6-month is higher than the 9-month, 9-month higher than the 12-month, and so on. So when we look at the yield curve spread, I need to put up a bond in order to just look at that yield curve. Well, what we get is an exceptionally flat environment from about 3 years out to 30 years. And for example, the 7-year is higher than the 10-year, and the 20-year is higher than the 30-year. Now, the 30-year is just about where the 5-year is. So the 5-year is higher than the 30-year. We're at an this is an odd type of situation where we're seeing different parts of the curve invert relative to others. Now, the Federal Reserve is talking about raising rates by 50 basis points, and they're talking about doing it a month from now. So within the next 4 weeks, we should at least anticipate that the 1 month is going to be in excess of 1%. Now, there's some speculation that we might have 4 50 basis point interest rate hikes between now and the end of the year. Well, if we were to get that, it would mean that every single point on the yield curve is inverted. Then the other big signal that we would get is that it's the swap curve. So when we get swaps that that invert, then that's also an indicator that something is untoward. So when we get different portions of the market becoming inverted, that's one signal. Then when we get additional types of yield curve inverting, that's also going to be something that is worth highlighting. And the swap curve is inverted. And I'm having trouble identifying the ticker. I do apologize for that. But we can see it down here. And the swap curve inverted a couple of months ago. We're now at a negative 5 basis point level. And it was inverted in 2019. It also became inverted very briefly in 2006. So that's another yield curve that is inverted. Now we can also look at high yield bonds. Now there are two ways of looking at high yield bonds. This is the yield curve version. So it's taking 10-year yields and taking away the 2-year yield on high yield bonds. And it's been contracting in 2021 and into 2022. And we're back in the region of lows that we saw back in 2019. Now, obviously, we had an incredibly inverted, well, it wasn't in fact inverted, but it almost got to an inversion point in 2020 because there was very near-term risk of defaults. And we saw a very inverted condition in 2009. So I think it is more correct to just simply pay attention to the fact that we had a pop on the upside, but that this curve is already back at where it was in 2019. We're also in the region of where it was back before the credit crisis in 2008. So this is something that also points as a warning signal that there's going to be a recession. Then the other way of looking at high yield bonds is with the high yield spread. So this is taking high yield bonds and taking the 10-year yield away from them. So they're currently trading at 367 basis points. And this is still a trend higher. Now, one thing that we can see historically is that this can move higher fast. So the trend alone is enough for caution. And we're seeing a little pause here in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And then it's worth highlighting that every time it gets above 500 basis points, trouble ensues. And we've had medium-term corrections in 2011, 2015, and 16, and then another big one in 2020, whenever high yield spreads go above 500 basis points. So we're not there yet. It can move quickly, so it could happen in the space of a week or maybe even 2 weeks. But the trend alone is certainly something that is pointing towards caution. Now, the other significant development is that banks had been doing really rather well until quite recently and are now underperforming. So the S&P 500 banks index has pulled back really quite sharply over the course of this year. And we're now back in the region of the upper side of that underlying trading range between 2018 and 2020 and the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Now, the running argument is that U.S. banks are better capitalized than international banks, and the trend up from that low in 2009, I think that helps to price all of that in. We've seen banks push on to new all-time highs and exceed the peak values from 2007. Now, of course, it's different. Banks are at new highs than the ones that were there in 2007. And companies like Citigroup They are still miles below where they traded back in 2007 and 8 and are now underperforming again. So this is still an exceptionally prolonged base formation for Citigroup. JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Wells Fargo, Bank of America have been doing better, but JP Morgan is now back in the region of that the 1,000-day moving average and the region of the peaks from back in 2018 and early 2019. So it's a sizable pullback. And a primary reason that banks are underperforming is because they're losing revenue streams. When we think about those yield curve spreads, so we've got an inverted yield curve or very close to it, and different portions of the yield curve are inverted. And if the Federal Reserve does in fact follow through on what's being priced into the bond markets, that they're going to raise rates by 2% between now and the end of the year, then that's really deleterious to banking margins because their entire business model is based upon borrowing short to lend long. And in an inverted yield curve scenario, that doesn't work. But on top of that, we have the fact that the mortgage rate in the USA is now in excess of 5% for a conventional loan. And this is a new high for the decade. So it basically means that anyone who's taken out a loan in the last 12 years has absolutely no need to refinance. Now, there's lots of people that are rushing out to buy homes, and their logic is that they want to buy before the price goes higher. And if interest rates come back down, they can always refinance later. But there's nobody refinancing today. So that's also robbing banks of an additional revenue stream. Then, of course, we have the significant decline in the performance of IPOs. So we still continue to see that some companies are going to list their stocks, like Steinway, for example. But the performance of these companies isn't especially impressive. And more importantly, the index is now, or the ETF, is encountering resistance in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So we're seeing a lot of leverage getting closed out of the system. And we're getting a significant differentiation in what investors are willing to buy. So there's a narrowing of breadth going on. Anything that is growth-oriented and does not have clear evidence of revenue and profit growth is getting pegged back in terms of upside potential in the eyes of investors. And the SPAC index is also back on its lows and not performing. A number of the ARK innovation ETFs, whether it's fintech or innovation, have a very similar pattern to the IPO index, and they have all completely unwound the bull market from the pandemic, from before the pandemic. But the challenge for companies like Shopify is that even after a massive pullback, it's trading on a price to sales ratio of 12. So it might be down from $1,700 to $600, but or $2,250 to $600, but it's still an expensive company. And this is an incredible crash for what had been one of the darlings of the investment community. So we know that people are losing money. And then we also know that in the bond markets, when yields go up, well, then that also means that investors are losing money. So people are going to cash. And the immediate prospect is that the dollar will continue to rise because investors are willing to bet that the Federal Reserve will in fact raise interest rates. So now people are starting to ask the question, well, wouldn't they be better off just going to cash? and perhaps coming back in and buying later, because there's certainly evidence of some contagion coming through. Because we can think about the different aristocrats. So they've been comparatively unaffected, but it's well off the highs for the week in here this week, and there's the potential that we're going to see some profit taking, not only in the unprofitable portion of the market, but in the kinds of companies that have got long records of turning in positive earnings, even during difficult times. So the dividend aristocrats are pulling back additionally in here today. And then, of course, we have the Fang Man shares, and that's also including Tesla. So this index has a striking similarity to the Nasdaq 100. And let's just bear in mind that the peak was in November, and it's now back in the region of its lows. So the one share that looks almost identical to the entire basket is Google, and it's breaking down in here today. So this is looking like a completing top formation. And it is quite likely that the first area of potential support is going to be around the 1,000-day moving average, which would be somewhere around 2,000. Now, the big challenge with looking at the positive outlook for earnings from companies like Google or Amazon or Microsoft or Apple, for that matter, is that investors look at, for example, their data centers, and they say, well, the data center business has been fantastic over the last decade, and it's contributed to the majority of profits, for example, for Amazon. And the challenge with that is that when you look at who their customers are, well, Netflix is an incredibly data-heavy business. Shopify is a data-heavy business. And all of these companies rely on companies like Amazon and Google to supply them with rack space. So when they start to see their businesses decline, they'll require less rack space. That means less revenue for companies like Amazon and Google. And of course, if these smaller companies then see their marketing budgets cut, well, then there won't be as much demand for advertising. And the cost of advertising and the revenue, for example, that Amazon has been generating from advertising, in fact, has exceeded its revenue from the web services division. So, but the more important point is, we had the loss of uptrend consistency. It's encountering resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. And we've seen occasions in the past where it has dipped below the 200-day moving average, but then it has rebounded really impressively. Now it tried to do that in March, and now it's failing. So we're potentially looking at a completing top formation in some of these companies. And this is incredibly important because they're huge in terms of their market cap. So when we think about the total assets or the total market cap of these companies, it got up to 23%. Now we're down to 20% of the total US market. If companies like Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, and Google break downwards, they're likely to contribute to a lot of selling pressure. And of course, there's a lot of money is tied up in these companies because investors have owned things like the SPY and the QQQ ETFs. And there's been this incredible swell of interest in ETFs over the course of the last decade. And it's been the primary vehicle for people to invest. And these are market cap weighted indices. So then it weighs on these indices when these big companies, and there's only eight of them, pull back. Now, it's also worth highlighting that we've already had a big pullback for significant numbers of shares. And the number of companies trading below their respective 200-day moving averages is pretty much around where it was back in 2010. And it's steadying a bit. But the reality here is that this isn't going to stop a correction overall, because when we start to see shares coming back below their 200-day moving averages, this measure doesn't look at how far below their 200-day moving average they are. What I think is more important right now is that the advanced decline line is rolling over. So there have also been occasions when the NYSE advanced decline line has traded below the 200-day moving average. The last time was in 2018. Isn't it interesting that it only got back to that level during the big sell-off in 2020? So now we're encountering resistance in the region of that 200-day moving average. So this correction is at least as meaningful as the one that we had in 2015. And it's as at least as widespread in terms of broad market underperformance. So we do need to pay attention to the fact that it's not over. There is the potential that it's going to get worse before it gets better. And the kinds of things that we monitor for predicting future recessions are starting to flash yellow. Now, some of those are or have improved over the course of the last couple of weeks. So the TED spread had pulled back over the course of the last 2 weeks, but now it's starting to push up again. And this is another one of those measures that it can move fast, and it can very quickly start to look like a problematic event. So we saw that historically, it doesn't generally tend to trade above 50 basis points. But when it does, it's generally an indication that there is stress in the global financial markets. Now, the one big difference that we have today that we did not have in 2018 is we do have a standing repo facility. So the USA has, I guess, they still have the reserve currency. And the Federal Reserve has basically said that they're going to stand behind the repo market. In other words, they're not going to allow what happened in 2008 to happen again. They will stand ready to supply as much liquidity as is needed in the event that the repo market starts to become problematic. And the OIS spread, which is overnight index swaps relative to LIBOR, has pulled back as well, but it will likely start to push back up again in the not so distant future. When we start to think then about what is the likelihood? Well, we know that yield curve spreads give us a lead indicator of anything from 6 to 18 months. And that implies that there will be a recession in 2023. And we're likely to start to see growth underperforming before long. So during the current earnings season, we've definitely seen that earnings have come through in quite impressive fashion. So Tesla was a good example of that this week. They came through with impressive earnings, but guidance wasn't great. And this is exactly what we had in with the last earnings season as well. We had companies coming through with really impressive fourth quarter earnings, particularly those Fangman companies, and then they said that their guidance wasn't going to be as impressive. So then we started to see them losing uptrend consistency subsequently. And we've definitely seen a lot of volatility on Tesla. Now, when we think about the outlook for bonds and the outlook for the dollar, well, we should take then an international perspective as well and think, well, if the dollar is continuing to strengthen, that means it is siphoning liquidity out of the rest of the world. So the USA appears most likely to aggressively raise rates, and yields there have rallied much more aggressively than elsewhere. And there's a good reason for that. So when we think about the UK, the pound was down in a dynamic manner in here today, down nearly 2 cents. So pushing back below the 130 area. And that's despite the fact that you had members of the Bank of England's Standing Committee talking about potentially being more aggressive in raising rates, but they're not going to be nearly as aggressive as what's being priced into the Fed. So the pound pulled back against the dollar. But when we think about then the relative comparison with the EU, well, the pound is also weak against the euro, and it's at the upper side of its base formation. So the potential here is that the growth slowdown that we're starting to see in the UK, where people are spending the same amount of money but they're buying less volume of inventory, that points towards a limit on how much money people have, and simply that they're not able to buy as much with it as they could before. That really points towards consumers being tapped out. And we're seeing it first in the UK, but it's likely we're going to see something similar everywhere else. Now, the one thing that everyone has been really focused on is inflation. And we've had lots of examples of massive spikes in commodity prices. And that has been especially the case in natural gas. So UK natural gas was, I don't think anyone ever really imagined that it would get as high as it did. But we're now back on the lows. So it has found support on numerous occasions around this 170 area, and it's testing it again this week. The reality is that every market is about supply and demand, and prices and inflation are robbing people of their ability to continue to pay. So as we move out of the winter season into more warmer weather, then there's a strong likelihood that natural gas prices will start to come back down. And then we have US natural gas, which broke on the upside earlier on this week and hit $8 and is now coming back down in a rather dynamic manner towards the end of this week. So it's down $1.50 from the peak that we saw earlier on. And this is not unusual. In fact, we've seen lots of occasions when we get these spikes in natural gas and then they come straight back down again. We're going to see more drilling. When oil companies are making as much money as they are, and we really have outsized profits, and profits have been driven both by high prices and then also by less expenditure on drilling, then they become targets. So the oil companies would rather spend the money than have to pay it over in taxes. But that also suggests that there will be more drilling. That means there will be more supply. And as economic growth starts to moderate, well, then we're likely to see lower energy prices overall. And that will also then put some pressure on some of these energy companies. So we're looking at a downside weekly key reversal on the S&P 500 energy sector. And it is really overextended relative to the 200-day moving average. So it could easily pull back by 100 and consolidate and range for a while. The big question is just how successful will central banks be in raising rates? We've already seen liquidity starting to come out of the market. We're already seeing stress starting to be experienced. When we then think about the home builders sector, rising inflationary pressures are eating into profitability, and we've had a reversion back down towards the 1,000-day moving average. I do think that anything that did especially well in 2020 and 2021 will probably unwind that massive move. When we think about the quantity of money that has been printed over the course of the last few years, we're talking about a truly extraordinary sum. And asset price inflation accompanies those kinds of moves. And now we can see that the money supply is contracting. We're almost back to what would have been considered high levels before the pandemic. And this is on a year-over-year basis. If we look at money supply on a month-over-month basis, well, then we really are back down to the kinds of levels that prevailed before the pandemic. And in fact, we're coming down towards the lows. So money supply is starting to dry up, and the Federal Reserve is talking about raising rates and simultaneously talking about reducing the size of the balance sheet. Well, there's only been two occasions when they did that, when central banks have in fact reduced the size of their balance sheets. And there's two big lessons from it. The first is that whenever they try to do it leads to deflation. And that's what we're looking at right now. So it's very, I think it's very clear that we could be in for a quite significant deep correction. Some people are going to be looking for a crash. And the fact that we have high valuations, high prices, and tightening monetary conditions means that there is a risk that we could see prices coming back in a really dynamic manner. When we have all of these speculative stocks that have already given up 60, 70, and 80% of their peak values, it is reasonable to anticipate that the companies that prosper most from their spending, which are the FAANG shares, would also then pull back and drag the rest of the market with them. That's not an unrealizable possibility. And the Federal Reserve hasn't even begun to reduce the size of its balance sheet yet. So if they go ahead and do it twice as fast as they did between 2018 and the middle of 2019, there are going to be repercussions. We're going to see growth slowing down. The reality is that they know as well as the rest of us that raising interest rates is going to do nothing to improve the supply of everything. It's not going to drill new wells. It will not ensure that crop yields improve. It's not going to stop the lockdowns in China. What it will do is kill demand. And that's what they want to do. So they're going to try and kill off demand. And it then, I think the only real question is whether the stock market pulls back first and blunts their enthusiasm for that solution, or we start to see interest rate hikes and it pulls back after. But it is practically impossible for asset prices to continue to rise when the supply of money is contracting. When we're at the chart seminar, and I have to say, I am really looking forward to getting back to the UK and visiting some of my favorite restaurants in London. But one thing that we talk about is that there really are only two topics in markets. There's money supply and crowd psychology. And money supply right now is front and center. Then, in terms of crowd psychology, there's the reality that we have been in a bull market since 2009, and the animating factor behind it has been liquidity. And arguably, that is still the case. So, I said there were two lessons from a contracting central bank balance sheet. And the second is that whenever they try to take money out of their balance sheets, they cause deflation, and the response to deflationary fears is to increase it again. And however much they take out, whatever the low value is, in the subsequent reflation period, the size of the central bank balance sheet has doubled. So let's say, for example, the Federal Reserve, because they're the ones that are talking about doing it this time, let's say they succeed and they take a trillion out of circulation and the stock market pulls back by between 20 and 30%. And we start to see energy prices coming back down and house prices in house price inflation disappearing and unemployment begin to tick upwards. Well, then, in order to avert a really deep recession, they would have to start reinjecting liquidity. And if history is any guide, whatever they get down to, maybe it's 7.5 trillion. Well, then it means that by the time they've finished reflating, the size of the balance sheet would be 15 trillion. So obviously, that would create a buying opportunity, and it would mean that we would get further asset price inflation. So will they be willing to do that? Because that's, I think that is the primary reason why people have been reluctant to sell. We've seen, and I think some of the conversations I've had in the last week have perhaps colored my view here. Because the first is that I had sat in with someone who was trying to sell me solar, and they offered me a fixed interest loan for 25 years at an interest rate of 1.49%. So that really is money for free when inflation is running at least 8% and the 30-year yield is around 3.2%. So that was, I think, a bit of a warning for me, because I've also seen during all these home renovations that I've been offered money left and right. And I've been going to various home decor stores like Home Depot and Lowe's and Floor & Decor, and they've all been offering me money for free. So I can get interest-free financing for 6 months or a year, or in Home Depot's case, all you have to do is ask them and they'll give it to you for 2 years. So considering that you don't have to pay any interest for 2 years, that's a significant discount when inflation is running where it is, and the share continues to pull back. And again, this isn't the first time it's been below the 200-day moving average. But if it's going to bounce, well, it's going to bounce within the next $30, or this is a completing top formation. So then the availability of that credit. And I did think it was interesting that it's Citigroup underwrites that credit, and Citigroup is underperforming right now. And then I had another conversation, and it was at with a real estate agent, and when he told me about the number of contracts that he's now seeing for people underwriting a cash purchase of a home with their stock portfolio, and Charles Schwab has a whole page devoted to doing just that. Well, this was also a bit of a warning situation. We have become conditioned to think that the Federal Reserve is going to ride to the rescue regardless of what happens. And that's been easily the most predictable thing in the market for at least the last 20 years. China at the moment is doing something a little different. They're not riding to the rescue of the property market. And at best, they're trying to just stabilize the stock market. And you have the central bank out today talking about the need to avoid an inflationary outcome and ensure stable prices and stable employment. Well, that's not suggesting that they're going to flood the market with liquidity, because they've been doing that. Every time there was a problem, they stepped in and they inflated the property price. And that created a wealth effect and helped the economy to jump back. But the economy has growth has been predicated on debt for a decade. And now they're looking at problematic after effects of that. So they're not willing to step in and massively inflate the size of the economy with new money any longer. Now, what they are doing is devaluing the currency. So we had a meaningful move for the renminbi in here this week. This has clearly broken the 2-year uptrend. And now it is quite likely that within the next perhaps 6 months, it's quite likely that, or I guess by the end of the year, that the renminbi will be back on its lows around the 7.2 area. So China is starting to support the economy, but they're not doing it in an aggressive manner to support asset prices. And of course, there is still all of this uncertainty about what is the global outlook going to look like. We do have some talk, at least, that they're ordering sovereign wealth funds to buy the stocks, but not in an aggressive manner. There is the potential that the Biden administration will lower some of the sanctions on China as they tend to concentrate more on Russia. One thing that I think is interesting is that the Republicans tend to be more China unfriendly in the USA, and the Democrats tend to be more Russia unfriendly. So if there's a change of administration, will they re-up on China and ease some of the sanctions on Russia? I don't think anyone is talking about that right now, but certainly the ambivalence of the different parties to different countries is something that is worth watching. The Federal Reserve is certainly talking tough, and I don't think that they're going to stop printing money. I think that given where we are, they're not going to have a lot of choice. Then we have the real possibility that we're at the dawn of a new secular bull market in commodities. Technology is starting to roll over. Interest rates are starting to rise, and inflationary pressures are starting to build. And well, I think, and a lot of people would argue that inflation is out of control, but it's really only been moving higher for about a year. And if this is anything like what we've seen in the past, then prices will move around a lot. And they will not come all the way back down. And we're definitely seeing more protectionist measures. So in the palm oil market, Indonesia has said that they're not going to export palm oil any longer, and they're one of the biggest exporters. So the price is still at trading north of 6,000 ringgit. And we've had a lot of volatility in the soft commodities market. But soft commodities are easier to increase supply of than industrial resources. Even with something like coffee, they can plant more trees. Now, it might take a while, and there's the 2-year cycle of productivity from trees that is also a factor, but they can plant more trees. And of course, with wheat, we've had a significant loss of productive capacity. But nonetheless, the acceleration is starting to peter out. And again, it's about demand. So once we start to see supply and demand come into balance, or we get substitution, or people basically end up having to eat less, then prices will start to come back down. And corn is also looking a little bit overbought in the short term. Now, it has been doing better than wheat has because one of the efforts to try and bring down gasoline prices has been to use more ethanol. So that helped to support the corn price. But I do think that when we think about the difficulties that farmers have in affording some of these things, well, Mosaic had a large downside key reversal in here this week. So this is a peak of at least near-term significance. Now, we've seen a massive move on the upside, where it's gone from 30 to 80 in a short period of time. And we're back in the region of the peak from back in 2011. So we're due some consolidation, and I think it is quite likely that we're going to get consolidation, and that anything that's really overextended on the upside like this is going to get pegged back. And we started to see some contagion coming through in the resources sector this week as well. So BHP Billiton also pulled back in a violent manner in here this week. Anglo American has been explosive on the upside over the last 6 years, but had a whopping downward dynamic in here this week. And this is more about rising costs than big misses in terms of production. We're not seeing a lot of investment in new mining capacity. And one thing that was, I think, probably slipped through in terms of commentary this week was that the European Union has doubled the pace with which they are capping carbon emissions. So carbon emission prices have popped on the upside. I tend to think of carbon emissions as the new bond market. They may not pay a dividend, but until quite recently, neither did bonds. But they have explicit government guarantees. So you're not going to lose all your money in carbon credits. And these represent the taxes that will be used to fund or subsidize the evolution of a renewable energy infrastructure on a global basis. And that implies that they're going to move higher. And this, I think, is going to be an investment class that's going to continue to attract adherents because it's government policy. And if the EU is successful in forcing its trading partners to adopt a similar viewpoint from the perspective of carbon emissions, well, then there's the possibility that within the decade, it's going to become a globally fungible commodity. And that's going to contribute to more price advances. When we think about the secular versus cyclical bull market argument for commodities, I think this is the basis for it. If it was just a cyclical problem and we saw a big move higher in commodity prices because of money creation, well, then it would be reasonable to anticipate that the prices would come straight back down again. But because we have this carbon market, and because of the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, then what we now have is energy security becoming a national priority. So there's going to be a lot more investment in renewable energy. You have the UK talking about putting in undersea cables all the way to Morocco, and then festooning the desert with solar arrays. And that's the kind of solution that would have been laughed off a decade ago. In fact, Germany has been talking about that for at least the last 6 or 7 years, and it's gone nowhere. But it is likely to happen in an environment where you have high carbon prices and where you have an urgent incentive for countries to adopt energy security type apparatus. And if that's the case, it's going to twin with the massive build-out of battery manufacturing capacity. But then we can think about the battery ETF, because it's also pulled back violently. And it also did exceptionally well during 2020 and 2021. So we're coming back into a rather interesting level here, because we know where the demand is coming from. We know where the trend of regulation is. And in an interest rate environment, which is uncertain, government sponsorship is going to be an important characteristic of future bull markets. So it's not like technological innovation has ended. And, in the last week, we've sort of seen this competition in trying to get out news or press releases about innovative ways to get satellites into orbit. And one company talking about a discus throw, and another using basically a gun to, or a cannon to shoot satellites into orbit. And this is very Jules Verne-ish in terms of what their view is. And one of the reasons why those types of guns were never built in the past was because they were considered to be an escalation in terms of the Cold War. So, plans for building these exceptionally large guns that could shoot munitions across the world were basically canned during the Cold War because they were too much of an escalation. And it appears that concerns like that are basically gone out the window with the invention of hypersonic missiles, which are basically first strike munitions. So there's also going to be a really significant build out of technology on the defense front, which will be twinned with telecommunications and energy. And this is also now a national priority. And it's a national priority just about everywhere. So this will be another government-sponsored type of operation. And it also suggests that governments aren't going to be particularly supportive of massively limiting liquidity. I think it's more likely than not what we're going to see is a growth scare. We're going to see a substantial pullback. We're going to see major indices test their respective 1,000-day moving averages. Then central banks will declare victory because commodity prices will have experienced a pullback, and then subsequently liquidity will start to improve again and will be moving into a new phase of this bull market. But we probably go down first and up afterwards. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.